Pre-order the new Samsung Galaxy S7 or S7 Edge with unlimited minutes and texts. With the Vodafone data extravaganza, we'll also throw in a huge 10 gigs of data. Visit your local Vodafone store or vodafone.co.uk. Vodafone. Power to you.
Pre-order ends 10th of March. Available on Red and Red Value bundles. Subject to availability, minimum term agreement and credit check apply. UK standard minutes and texts.
This is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. There are a lot of stories about friendship, community, and survival that have been born from AIDS. There are plays and movies that underscore the anger and the activism, and music that defines the tragedy. But for every song and every movie, there is a person. There is a community. There are friends that must embrace the bittersweet realities of life and of death. There are loved ones buried too early. Today on Arrivals, the story of three friends, a disease, and the opera.
I mean, we've both kidded about the fact that, I don't think either one of us are ugly. I think both of us are pretty normal looking. But that if we were if we were devastatingly handsome, I think I would have been dead. I really do. In the first 4 years of AIDS. My name is Darren Nimnick. I'm 63 years old and live in New York City in Chatham Center, New York.
I'm Tom Cicero. I am 63 years old. We're originally both from Los Angeles area. We moved to New York, and now I'm retired and live in Chatham Center.
He was in the opera Marriage of Figaro, and I was in the chorus.
We both had boyfriends, and we both ended up breaking up with our boyfriends and getting together. Tom went to Japan on a singing tour, called me from Hawaii to say, when I get back, I'm moving in with you. Okay. And he moved in, and we've been together ever since. I did the Metropolitan Opera auditions, and then, surprise to me, was offered a contract at the end of the auditions. So that happened in May of 1980, and by September, we packed up the truck from Los Angeles, got rid of our cars, and moved to New York City. I met Norman Anderson. My first day, I got my contract. Norman came up to me and introduced himself. He walked up and put out his hand and said, "Hi, my name's Norman Anderson. Who are you?" And I said, "My name's Darren Nimnick." And he said, "What are you saying?" And I said, "Baritone." He said, "I'm a bass." I didn't know until 6 or 9 months later. Norman did not do that. He didn't come to someone. And we just clicked. And I don't know why. And we became really fast friends. That year we went on the Met tour. But I heard him sing, and he had this just incredibly beautiful, mellifluous, gorgeous sound. It wasn't one of those that like a hammering sound. It was, they say, profundo, but it was just this beautiful, velvety, dark sound. What he presented on a day-to-day basis was what looked like, to me, a very elegant, old-world kind of New York person. It wouldn't have been odd for me to see him with a walking stick. And he presented himself that way. And this beautiful beard that was always trimmed, and his height. And then the other thing would be in full leather. He knew that I wasn't at all, and we would go out to the bars together, And, you know, he would be in his chaps and everything. And whenever he didn't want someone to, like, approach him, he would say, okay, you're my husband. And he'd put his arm around me.
And Darren would be in a Hawaiian shirt and Bermuda shorts.
I would be in a Hawaiian shirt and shorts. So it would be the two of us. It was, and we clicked, and you don't know why friendships happen like that. Matter of fact, it was funny. Everyone assumed, because Norm and I were so close, that we had slept together. And it was funny because he was devastatingly handsome, but he wasn't my type at all. I mean, he was 6'4", strawberry blonde hair and beard, wore incredible clothes, loved to wear, you know, Burberry suits. And I mean, he was, even at the Met, he would always wear a sports coat and a pocket square, and he had broad shoulders, thin waist, but he was really into leather and piercings. And he would get very mad that people would talk about him at the Met about his piercings. And I would say to him, Norman, you know, if you have two tit rings in a silk shirt, they're going to notice them. If you don't want them to notice them, don't wear the jewelry. He found out in 85, it was the early days of AIDS, so it was different. He I think, got his full diagnosis when he started getting thrush. He started getting infections in his mouth.
Yeah, that was late 80s then.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
Norman bought this house in 87, lived here until 93.
It's the house that everyone wants. It's a suite, just big enough, house in the country with a stream and a barn on a fairly quiet road with horses around us.
I do think part of it is that when he was diagnosed, I don't think he wanted to be in New York. He wanted land, he wanted something quiet, he wanted... And that's something, I mean, especially me, people that know me, Mr. Loudmouth, that we would come up here, and part of the best part would be just sitting out on the back deck at night, looking at the stars, listening to the peepers, the frogs, listening to the cicadas. That this was, I think, he bought this as a balm to his soul. He would get up in the mornings and cook, start baking, like blueberry cobbler, 7 in the morning, and have opera on, and we would do that all day. You redefine your relationships, and you redefine who your families are. And Norman and Tom and I became a family. And that's why, to this day, as I said, we'll do something and I'll go, I think Norman would like this.
Even though he had this persona of being very... very strict
grand.
And very grand, and that he was,
that was
always, he always was laughing with us and having a good time, and we enjoyed life.
We became good friends, and there was nothing that we didn't talk about, including, which I think is really important, and I've done this ever since, losing Norman, which is one of the first, other than, you know, your grandparents and all that, losing them earlier, as everyone does, that it was important to talk about death, and to talk about, because people that are dying want to kind of talk about it and voice things about it, whether it's their fear or their lack of fear or what's going to happen. And so many times, especially I think American culture is very afraid to talk about death and afraid how that's going to affect their friendship with someone. And he wanted to, so that when he got sick and when he told us, you know, I can do those things like when Kennedy died, you'll always remember where you were. We were out on the back deck and he said, I don't want to talk about this, but I'm leaving you guys the house. We always listened to loved operas, and I would find, you know, the newest recording or something. We'd come up here, he'd be in the bedroom, and we'd put on opera, and we'd listen to it. And at one point, we were listening, of course, profound, we were listening to La Traviata. Of course, La Traviata, Violetta dies of consumption. And at a point in the last act where, you know, she's very, very sick and singing, he said, "I never thought it would take this long." And I said, "What?" He said, "Dying." He said, "I thought it would always be very operatic. I would take one big last breath and I would die." And I said, "I know." And he said, "I just want it to be over," because at that point there was nothing was going to make him well. And he'd gone from this strapping 6'4" man that weighed like 170 pounds of muscle to a 6'4" man that weighed less than 90 pounds. So. That was our first time knowing and taking care of someone that had a terminal illness.
Yeah.
It's a gift in a weird way. It's a gift that you wouldn't have when you know someone because you get to say goodbye.
Well, it's weird. It's like something else kicks in. It's like all of a sudden your priorities change. And you, because it was so, it felt urgent that you didn't think about it. You just went into overdrive and said, this is what we need to do. In a way, too, because there was so much going on around us. And a lot of the people that, you know, we knew that died, they weren't close friends. They were, you know, people we knew from theater and all that. And so, you know, we didn't have the same bond as we did with Norman. And when Norman got sick, to me, it was sort of a thing, finally, I can do something. I can help. You know, maybe just this one person, but I'm going to try to make their life easy, you know, and take care of them. So in a way, it felt like I was contributing and helping someone and doing something positive in a way. You know, I don't want to say helping someone die, but just helping them live now.
To where, like I said, when Norman saying, you know, "I never thought it would take this long," people want to talk about that and what will happen. And it was very important to him. Once he told us he was leaving us the house, he was funny and said, "And one of the reasons I'm leaving you the house is I want to be spread in the peony garden." And I said, "You know, your mom is going to want some of your ashes." He said, "Yeah, you can give her like a third, but I want 2/3 of me here." And it became, I think it becomes, it helps them. It also, in a way, keeps you from grieving. You don't have time to grieve. You have to take care of the person. And by the time when Norman died, we were stopped up here on our way to P-Town. So
it was the first vacation we had had in years
because we'd been taking care of him. The healthcare, Regina said, you know. So we planned. We came up from New York to here in our rental car. And we came. We saw him. We said goodnight. And by the time we, 4 or 5 hours later, we were P-Town, Regina called us to say that he had passed away.
And you don't grieve at that point. No. You're sad and you miss the person, but you're glad that that part of their suffering is over.
So we went and picked up the urn, and, you know, when you do this, if people don't know, it looks just much like a coffee can without painting. It's not very, you know, it's just a pretty simple...
It's a can.
It's a can. And we were driving down because he was having the funeral in New York was at,
St. Thomas?
No, not Church of the Heavenly. It's a very gay-friendly church on 23rd off
for
of
actors.
Actors, anything. So we went down there and we had the can. We had the can in the trunk, and we parked around, I don't know, 20th Street, and we opened the trunk and we had another more beautiful urn to have at the service, and we started scooping out ashes and putting in, and some of them were blowing around, and a lot of people won't remember this. There was a movie called Prick Up Your Ear, and it was the story of Joe Orton. And Joe Orton was murdered by his lover. And one of the requests he had when they died, they both died, was that their ashes be mingled. And at the end of the movie, Vanessa Redgrave plays his agent. And she is standing at the counter, and Joe Orton's sister is taking a scoop of Joe Orton's ashes and then a scoop of his lover who killed in ashes, and is putting it in a middle urn. And she's talking to the agent, and she goes, she realizes that she doesn't know if she's taken equal amounts of scoops, that she's lost track of which one she did. And she goes, oh, it's very English, she goes, I've forgotten where I am. And Vanessa Redgrave says, it's a gesture, dear, not a fucking recipe. And that's what we thought of that day. As he was blowing, I said to Tom, I looked at him, I said, it's a gesture. It's not
a
fucking
gesture. I think it was in Washington Square Park or something
like that. Yeah, it was one of, yeah.
And so we're out there and it's windy and we're trying to get ashes and say, well, we don't want her to have all the ashes. We want most of them. But the ashes are going everywhere.
And then we went to the, you know, we did the memorial. And then we came up here and did a memorial and actually on the back deck of the house and invited most of the friends he had here. And then I played music. The music that was part of the service was all the sopranos that he had sung with at the Met, or the recordings I used. So you certainly grieved over the life of the person, but you didn't, I don't think, you concentrated on the death part. I had friends that even though they didn't die, if they got sick or if they just left New York. You know, they moved someplace else. It was just too much. The grief was too much because, you know, it was that thing of going, losing so many. I mean, 30 or 40 people when you're 30 years old, you know, you're not ready at that point to do it. The nice thing about life is you get older and as you have 40, 50, 60 years, it all is kind of a natural thing that happens. You understand it. People are going to die, and you know, that's just part of life. I think once you lose so many people at 30, it's like having someone, you know, all your friends killed in a bus accident or something. It's just like, it's such a devastating thing, you don't know how to deal with it.
Suicides were happening, as opposed to dying of AIDS. There were a lot of suicides and a lot of overdoses and things like that. So people who were ill, but
didn't want to go through the...
Yeah, they didn't want to go through the suffering, so they were doing other things.
I would say that I went to, in 1 year... 9 or 10, and I was lucky. But, you know, you sometimes would see the same people from memorial to memorial, and it would be, I mean, the other thing that developed, a lot of black humor. You know, you laugh to not cry. You know, you would say to someone, well, I can't believe I'm seeing you again, or at least I'm seeing you again at this memorial. And so you had this bond, if you were had been in a central core of people that you performed with, you at least got to spend time with them again and catch up and, you know, leave hugging someone and saying, you know, take care, and you really meant take care because you didn't know the next time you'd see them. I had a couple of friends at the Met die that within 2 months, and at this point Leontine Price had stopped singing as an operatic soprano and one of the world's most famous. And within 3 months, I saw her at 3 memorials singing. And I remember going up to her and saying, you know, you could have a whole career of this. And, you know, we laughed. And how sad it was, you know, that you were ending up singing at friends' funerals because they'd asked her to sing at them. And that's how most of the memorials I went to were. They were more a celebration, and you left feeling good. You didn't leave. You left with the loss of the person you loved. But you left feeling, wow, we sent this person out with a real bang.
One of the things when we first were up here, I think Norma was still alive, but we were having this party. There were all the people. The place was lit up, and it was dark in that. And Darren and I went for a walk, and we were walking outside to look in. And at that time, there was a movie out called Howard's End.
Well, because it was just... the beginning of Howard's End is Vanessa Redgrave is the same thing. There's a dinner party inside the house. She's in this gorgeous long dress, and it's dewy outside, and she walks outside, and she walks around and looks in and sees all of this, you know, all lit by candlelight, all of her friends there. And then we come up here, and it struck both of us that we just kind of walked outside and turned around, and I said to Tom, oh my God, this is Norman's End, which ironically, it became.
Gay men have that youthful thing going all the time of, oh, let's party, let's do this, let's do
that. I'll never die.
When Norman died, I matured. All of a sudden, we have house payments. We had to take care of Norman's estate. So we had to grow up and mature a lot. And so it was one of those things that we missed Norman at, but his dying really brought us to another...
It was a new part of our life.
Yeah,
new life. Being an adult. And looking back to me in retrospect now, being in my early 60s, it's something to, you know, kind of wrap your mind around. People were dying so quickly in the early onset of AIDS, in the mid-80s to late-80s. People would get a diagnosis and a month later be dead. You would hear a friend going to the hospital and they would die. You were angry. You didn't understand. I mean, but fear, a huge amount of fear, because no one knew. I mean, by then we knew or where AIDS was coming from, that was the HIV virus. But before that, it was just panic.
The condition severely weakens the body's ability to fight disease. Many victims get a rare form of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. Others get an infection known as pneumocystis pneumonia.
It's just part of how life happens, but it's still, I miss the social, the real socialization that happened in the 70s and in the 80s due to the fact that people were not afraid to be out. And there was a cause to bond them together as
yes,
well.
Yes, there was.
So you had this thing that you talked a lot, we talked earlier. You talked about people being sick or what's going on, and there was a fun part of it, and there was a not so fun part of it. But it just doesn't seem like you have it as much.
Is there anything that I haven't asked about Norman that I should know?
Oh, boy. Let me see if I can do this and not do what I do all the time and tear up again. One gesture by a friend can change your life. We would have not, I don't think we would ever, because of financially what we were doing. I was singing opera, Thomas freelancing. We would have never had money to save up for a down payment. I don't think we would have ever had a home. And the fact that Norman did this and gave us this opportunity, I always think about. And because it changed our lives. And it made us happy. It has made us happy for 25, 30 years.
This episode is dedicated to Norman. A very special thanks to Darren and Tom, and to Ben Riskin for producing a story so full of heart for our show. This episode of Arrivals was created in the late hours of the evening, across the road from all-night wedding receptions, in the lovely Montecito Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles, California, by me, Jonathan Hirsch. Our associate producer is Nora Lind, and illustrations for the show are from Steph Tan. Find out more at our website, arrvls.com. There's an Arrivals microcast called En Route, with extended interviews, conversations, and outtakes from our episodes, which you can find there as well. This week, producer Tally Abacasis and I talk about approaches to audio documentary and working together on episode 28 of Arrivals, Junji.
It's like that cliche where you see the person, there's voiceover and they're telling you about something, but you just see them walking down the street. Like there's always those like the walking shots like that drive me crazy. And it's because they have the parts of the video where they're saying something interesting and they don't have anything to illustrate it. So they have the person walking down the street. So in audio, it's really refreshing to be able to kind of really buckle down and focus in on tell me where you were at that moment.
This show is proud to be a member of The Herd, a storytelling audio collective featuring six producers from across North America who have banded together to share resources and to promote one another's work. Check out Nocturne from Vanessa Lowe.
When I swam the English Channel, I felt in the middle of the night, I felt like these heads rolling around me, like people had their heads cut off and they were rolling around and they couldn't, and I kept swimming and these things kept rolling around. And finally I yelled up to Reg Brickle and said, "What is in the water with me?" And he just started laughing. He said, "Well, there was a barge that went by and it had a bunch of lettuce heads on board and they were rotting, so they just threw them overboard. So you're swimming through lettuce heads."
And if you have a story of migration, transformation, or change you'd like to share with the program, email me at arrivalsshow@gmail.com. However you spell it, I'll get it. Coming up on Arrivals, as far as my own mystical experience, I began to work very intimately with tarot and to learn it very, very well. I learned all of the meanings that were in this little 300 and some odd page book, memorized them fairly exactly. And so when I would sit down and read tarot for someone, they would not just have to take my word for it like I had powers or something. They would be able to go to the text and look up whatever it was, and they'd be like, oh, he's right. That is what the Hanged Man indicates. Or, you know, whatever.
I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.